The brain is still an undiscovered country in spite of all our advances. But who knew that the organ we count on to interpret reality for us has its own bias? Turns out the brain sees the world through rose-colored glasses. To the brain, the future looks better than the past, and our choices are usually for the best. It's not bad unless you want to see the world as it really is. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Tali Sharat. She's a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Center for Neuroimaging at the University College London. Her latest book is called The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. And we welcome your calls this hour. Why do you think the brain is hardwired toward optimism? Is it better to be depressed and realistic or happy and unrealistic? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org or join us on Facebook. It's the Veronica Rickert Show. And Tali Sharat, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, it's great to be on the show.
I think a lot of people really pride themselves in their capacity to be realistic, to be rationalist, to make those good decisions based on reality. But it turns out we might have a disadvantage in all of that, our own brains.
Well, I don't think it's a disadvantage. I think it's true that most people think they're very rational. We think we can predict the future in a realistic manner. And that turns out not to be true. So we have specific biases. One of it is the optimism bias, which means we expect the future to be slightly better than it ends up being. People tend to overestimate the likelihood of positive events happening in their lives and underestimate the likelihood of negative events happening in their lives. So, and this kind of optimism is really an illusion. We're not aware of it. So many times people will come to the lab and will say, I'm very rational, I'm very realistic. But, you know, they still exhibit the bias without being aware of the bias. And it's not necessarily a bad thing because there's a lot of positive aspects to being slightly optimistic.
Well, give us some examples of the optimism being an advantage.
Well, the biggest advantage, I think, is that optimism is related to better mental health and physical health. So let's start with physical health. So optimists tend to live longer and be healthier. I'll give you one example. A survey of 100,000 females from the age of 50 to 65 found that the optimistic females were more likely to survive during those years. So they were 14% less likely to die and 30% less likely to die from cardiac arrest between those ages. There's many studies also showing that cancer patients, AIDS patients, cardiac arrest patients all survive longer if they're optimistic, all else, of course, being equal. So their initial health is equal. And so why is it? Why does optimism enhance our physical health? There's two reasons for it that we think. First is that if you expect positive events in your future, that reduces stress and anxiety. And we know that, you know, reducing stress and anxiety is very good for our health. The second reason is that if you think you're going to recover from an illness, if you think you're going to be healthy, that then motivates you to take the actions needed to actually become healthy. So, for example, optimists have been shown to be more likely to take vitamins, follow doctor's orders, exercise. So, and, you know, whilst if you don't think you're going to be healthy and recover, you just do nothing. It becomes a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think that's one of the big advantages. The second advantage is to our mental health. So it seems that most people are optimistic. So about 80% of the population have an optimism bias. Now we're going to look at the other 20%. What about those who don't? Within those 20%, a large proportion are actually clinically depressed. So individuals who tend to not have a bias at all when viewing the future, who have more realistic expectations, they tend to be mildly depressed. And individuals who have a pessimistic bias, who tend to think that the future will be a little bit worse than it ends up being, they tend to be quite severely depressed. So optimism is very tightly related to our mental health, and that's the other advantage.
There's how also do we know what
reality really is. I mean, there's the whole Shakespearean idea that nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And don't our thoughts sort of influence our future? So how can you, as a scientist, get a handle on what is truly a good representation of reality?
Well, it's actually not that difficult to do. What we do is we bring people in our lab and we ask them to estimate different things that are going to happen. For example, we can ask them, please estimate what's going to happen in the next month. How likely are you to get stuck in traffic, to have a nice dinner, to get a gift? And then we bring them back at the end of the month to see what happened and what did not happen. And so we can look at the difference between their expectations and outcome in these everyday events. You can also ask them about expectations for bigger outcomes. So you can ask, for example, MBA students were asked, what do you think your first salary is going to be? How many job offers are you going to get? And then when they graduated started their first job, they actually looked at their salary and how many offers, and they can contrast it. You know, I can ask you, how many years do you think you're going to be married? And you know, I can go back, I can go in a few years and see if your prediction became reality or not. So to actually measure the extent of our bias is not a difficult thing to do, and this is very important for our science, because if we can measure something, it's much more easy for us to try and investigate it. Now, it's true that our predictions change the outcomes, but that's part of it. So it's true that if I ask you, do you think you're going to get many job offers upon graduation, and you say, yeah, I think I'm going to get 4 or 5, that expectation then will change the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
That's true as well, right? But still, we can look at the bias. We can look at the difference between your expectations and the outcome.
So it's more, it sounds like, a projection of how accurately we can imagine our future. There's some component of future imagining that's tied into all of this.
Yeah. So imagination is a really important part of how we see the future and of planning. We actually imagine all the time. We use imagination every day, and quite a large percentage of the day we actually engage in imagining. So it could be something as simple as you just imagine what you're going to have for lunch, you're going to have for dinner, or you might imagine what you're going to do on the weekend, or, you know, what you're going to do during the holiday vacation, what is going to happen in a few years, and so on and so. So we use imagination all the time, and by imagining things, then we can try and conclude how likely they are. So what people usually do, if they imagine the dinner and, you know, they imagine themselves making a bolognese, it's then more likely for them to say that this will actually happen. So there's a tight relationship between how easily and how vividly we can imagine future events and how we think they are actually going to transpire.
So I guess in terms of optimism, you'll be much more motivated to create that outcome for yourself if it looks more attractive.
Absolutely. I mean, optimism on its own just means that we expect positive events, right? We expect good. We expect the future to be good. And what really it means that we expect the things that we hope to come true. So we have hopes. We're hoping to, you know, be successful in our careers and have a happy family. And so those are our hopes. Optimism means that we expect those things to become true. The optimism bias means the difference between our expectations and the outcomes. And of course, if you believe that what you hope for will become true, that has a positive effect on your emotional state. So you're, of course, going to be happier and if you believe your future will be rosy.
Well, it's not always wine and roses, the optimism thing. There are downsides to having an optimistic brain as well. For instance, you might decide that you shouldn't get a health issue checked out, or you shouldn't save. Maybe it's not necessary to put as much away in savings for retirement, because, of course, things will turn around. It seems as though we kind of have to walk that line.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of positive aspects to optimism, as we discussed, but there's also these negative aspects. As you said, if you think you're going to be healthy, you might not go to medical screenings. You'll say, no, I don't need to. You might not put your belt on or a helmet on when you ride your bike. You might not buy insurance. And maybe one of the big examples in the last few years was the financial downfall of 2008, because the optimism bias has been named by economists to be one of the core reasons before the financial downfall. It was optimism of individuals and financial officials and government officials and financial analysts, and they all had this optimism that the market will continue to grow and grow. And although there was evidence to the contrary, people ignored that evidence, and that led to this big, big bubble, which, you know, I think it's now that we know about how the brain works and the fact that we have this bias, maybe it seems quite natural to have had that. But that, in fact, ended up in quite a disaster. So there are these negative consequences to optimism, which is why it's really important for us to understand it. We really need to understand what it means, how it comes about, what are the consequences, so we can actually avoid the negative ones while still embrace the positive.
Do you think there are political implications here as well? I mean, you talked about the financial crisis being one example of maybe optimism run a little amok. But what about whether or not people would vote for different parties based on this brain bias? Maybe they'd vote for, I don't know, either the candidate who has the more positive message, or maybe on the flip side, maybe they'd vote for the candidate who seems to protect wealth of the wealthy better. Because they see themselves as pre-rich.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. There has actually been a few studies on this. So one study, which was conducted, I think, in the 80s by Martin Seligman and his colleagues, they took speeches of presidential candidates and I think maybe Congress as well from back many, many years. And they tried to look at those transcripts, and they coded those transcripts on what they call an optimistic or pessimistic exploratory style. So that's kind of a measure that they have, which can indicate how optimistic or pessimistic someone is. And on 90-something percent of the cases, they could, just based on those transcripts and the ratings of optimism, they could say which candidate won. So, and you can predict, and then they had another study where they actually predicted in one of the last elections who's going to win based on these ratings of what they call an optimistic exploratory style. So it is true that the more optimistic a candidate is, according to these two studies, the more likely they are to win. I think one of the reasons maybe is because that kind of really catches and kind of the need of the people for a positive message about the future, their need for hope and optimism. And so if someone managed to kind of tap into that, probably they're going to get more votes. Of course, there should be some balance, right? It still has to sound probable as well at the same time.
Well, one thing that really struck me as I was reading your book is that it is those people with mild depression who tend to be the best realists about life. And I wonder, it seems like an advantage to be realistic about what you would be able to achieve, what's going to happen, but it's the optimists who have the edge. Why is that?
So I hear that a lot. People say, well, should we be depressed? Then we have no bias. Absolutely not. I think it speaks for itself that depression is obviously not something that any of us wants. You know, it's low mood and low affect and you have problems functioning in every parts of your life, and suicide is related to depression, and this is obviously something not good. Being having no bias when projecting the future is one component of mild depression. It's not everything, right? Depression has other components as well. Now, the reason that it's actually, on average, it's better to have an optimistic bias, a mild optimistic bias, than not. There are so many studies showing that. Now, on the other hand, you don't want to have an extreme optimism. So there's, for example, a study showed that extreme optimists are more likely to smoke than mild optimists. And now the good thing is that most of the population are not extreme optimists. Most of us are mild optimists. It means we have slightly better expectations of what will happen.
You mean the people who are the most optimistic smoke because they don't think they would ever get lung cancer, for instance?
That's the assumption, yes. Yes.
Okay.
So if you're extreme optimist, it seems that at that point, the negative outweighs the positive. But if you're mildly optimistic, it seems that the positive, we talked about, you know, that the good advantages for our physical health, there's also connection between optimism and achievement in academia, in sports, in politics, in the military. So people who are optimistic tend to do better in all these domains. therefore, I mean, the very, very strong conclusion in any study is that mild optimism is the most optimal for achievement, for health, for mental health, for physical health, even for relationships. It's been shown that although optimists are not likely less likely to divorce, they are more likely to remarry. Again, it's kind of the hope here wins. There's a quote by Samuel Johnson saying, remarriage is a trimester of hope over experience. So it's just, you know, we just have to look at the data in front of us, and it shows us that having no bias is not advantageous. You have to, I read once somewhere someone said, you have to think that you're going to get the gold medal in order to get the silver.
It sounds like there's also some discussion about optimism being useful in that it's sort of the counterweight to the dread that we inherently feel as human beings because we have knowledge about our own future death.
Yes. So there's a theory by evolutionary biologists saying that at some point in time, humans evolved this understanding of themselves, of the future, the consciousness. So we evolve a consciousness that enabled us to see into our own future. And when we looked into our own future, inevitably we saw that death awaits and old age awaits and illness awaits. And according to this theory, that knowledge on its own would be so devastating that it would actually put to a stop the actions needed for survival. But if that kind of consciousness and awareness of our future and the end of our future came alongside with an optimism bias, that meant that in some ways people could twist this kind of knowledge. And because of that, humans could actually go on and develop still having this kind of knowledge that death awaits, but at the same time denying it as well. And this kind of helps us in our everyday life.
So we kind of have to tell ourselves, sure, we're going to die, but I guess it won't be that bad, and we'll do all this other cool stuff in the meantime. And that gets us through
the night.
Or we
don't really believe it, you know? I think many people don't really truly believe it, yes.
Do we have a choice about whether we're optimists or not, or is it something we're just born with?
So it's a little bit of both. The genetic component is quite substantial. So there's a couple of studies linking specific genes to optimism. And it seems that if you have one type of that gene, you're more likely to be optimistic. If you have another type of the same gene, you're more likely to suffer from depression. However, our experiences in life matter as well. So one of the studies showed that if you have that gene that related to depression, you're likely to suffer from depression only when you also experience stressful life events. So it seems to be a little bit of a combination. How we can make ourselves more or less optimistic, there is a little bit of kind of theories here and there, but not a lot. So it's for now, we don't really have, I can't really say yes, if you do this or that, you're definitely become more or less optimistic. It seems that our natural tendency is quite strong. But that does not, you know, it doesn't mean that we, if we are one way or the other, if we're, especially, I mean, if we're optimistic, usually we don't, so this is how I see it. If you're optimistic, what I think is that is a good thing. But at the same time, if you become aware of the negative aspects of optimism, you can then take actions to protect yourself without being less optimistic. Hmm. Let me give you an example. So the British government have what they call the Green Book, which is a book with recommendations for project appraisers in the government. And they say in this book that all the government projects have to be adjusted for the optimism bias. So all the budgets have to be adjusted for the optimism bias. Because what happens is that because of the optimism bias, we tend to underestimate how much things are going to cost us. And we tend to think that our projects are going to be done sooner than they are. And that's true on a government level, but it's also true on an individual level because, you know, if you've renovated your house, for example, you know that most people think it will cost less than it ends up costing and it will take less time, something with wedding planning. So what they say is you have to adjust the budget. And the 2012 Olympics, which is going to take place in London, has already been, the budget has already been adjusted for the optimism bias. And it's one of the first Olympics, which is actually on budget. And, for example, my friend is getting married, and he said he added an optimism bias aspect to his budget and to, you know, how long things are going to take. And so, you know, he's optimistic, and
wow.
his fiance is very optimistic, but they, because they're aware of this, given that they are my colleagues, they decided to take action. So they're not less optimistic, but they now take actions to protect themselves. And this is something we can do all the time.
So this is mainstream enough that there are governments who are working with this concept already in their budgeting process?
You mean the knowledge of it?
Right.
I know about the British government. I don't know of any other governments. So it could be, it needs to be a bit more mainstream. And I think what we've been doing in the last few years has helped because the optimism bias on its own has been shown since about the 80s. What's new that we've done in the past, I guess, now 5 or 6 years, is we have shown how this happens in the brain, and we've shown that given the data that we have, it's likely to think that it's probably hardwired. And this data and this knowledge about coming from neuroscience, I think that convinced people a little bit more to pay attention. And it seems to me that slowly, more and more people are paying attention to this. And I guess maybe the financial downfall of 2008 was also a big kind of alarm.
Well, Tali Sharan is our guest this hour. She is a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Centre for Neuroimaging at University College London. Her latest book is called The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. And we want to know what you think. Why do you think the brain is hardwired toward optimism? And do you see it as better to be depressed and realistic or happy and unrealistic? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, keeping you company this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We need your support. We have a one-day pledge drive coming up on Tuesday, December 13th, and your gift right now helps the drive succeed. Your pledge also enters you in a drawing for an iPad. Get all the details and make your year-end gift at WPR.org. Our guest this hour is Tali Sharan. She's a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Center for Neuroimaging at University College London. And this hour, we're talking about her latest book. It's called The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. And we'll take our first phone call now. We've got Bill joining us from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I'm a little confused, I guess, because as long as I can remember, since the time I was, even before high school, I'm now 60. I've always had maybe a pessimism bias because I don't know. My childhood had a fair amount of traumas in it. Plus, my on my mother's side, there is a long history of mental illnesses, mostly related to depression. I don't know whether my bias has been because of genes or because of experience, but I don't remember ever thinking as a child. You always kids behave like they're going to live forever. That's become a cliche. I never felt that way. I mean, I always assumed that I could die at any moment. I never took for granted that I was going to survive. I was convinced that World War III I would never live past the age of 30 or so. I don't take for granted that for example, when my wife and I renovated our house, they came up with an estimate for what it was going to cost, and my wife was more or less on board with that, and I said, well, we better double that. And sure enough,
you were right.
I was close. And because things come up, I said, things come up. You pull up a board, you pull up and you see, oh, this joist is rotten. We got to take care of this, things. But generally, I don't know whether my pessimism bias is hardwired because of my genetic background with mental illness, or whether it's because of, I did witness a lot of. Did experience a lot of fairly traumatic events as a kid, and I don't know what was the cause of it.
Okay, well, thank you, Bill. Tali?
Yeah, so as I said, it's about 80% of the population who hold an optimism bias and 20% that do not. So 2 out of 10 will not hold an optimism bias. Those people do tend to, not all of them, but a large percentage of the 20% do tend to have some level of depression. It can be a low level of depression, which means, for example, that if you test them on symptoms, they have symptoms which will indicate mild depression, but according to the psychological diagnosis, it's called DCM, they won't have diagnosed depression. So that's kind of the mild depression. Then you have severe, which are diagnosed psychiatrically and have a high amount of symptoms. The description here is of someone who has a history of depression in their family, and also experienced stressful life events. Statistically, those two things do have a correlation with some sort of depression, either mild or high. It doesn't mean that they have at all. It doesn't mean someone who has a history and also suffered life events, it doesn't mean that they automatically will have depression, but there is a correlation between the two, and these people do tend to not be optimistic. And so I don't know about this case at all, but everything that he said so far makes sense. So someone who does not have an optimism bias and also has a history of depression, therefore maybe a genetic disposition plus the experience of stressful life events, that's quite common within that 20% of people who are not optimistic.
Do we know anything about those 2 of 10%, either the 2 out of 10 people who have the more pessimistic bent to their mind? Do we know anything about their levels of sort of prosperity and well-being as compared to the optimists?
Well, because it's related to mental illness, because it's related to depression, either mild or severe, well-being is usually reduced. So optimism is related to higher well-being. And any kind of mental illness is usually related to lower well-being and lower levels of happiness and satisfaction, partially because of the stressful life events that they go through.
Well, let's take our next phone call now. We've got Paul joining us from East Troy. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is interesting. Many, many years ago, I wrote my dissertation using a psychological construct called locus of control, which... Oh, golly, I don't know if I can give a great definition of it, but basically it's the extent to which we feel that we are in control of not necessarily the events that happen in our lives, but our reaction to those events. And generally, an internal locus of control means just that, that people feel they are kind of controlling of their reactions to events, and an external locus of control means people feel somewhat buffeted about and not in control. I'm just wondering if you are familiar with the term, if the guest is familiar with the term, and if there, it certainly seems like there would be a correlation. I'll take my response off the air.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Tali?
Yeah, thank you. That is actually a very important concept in optimism, control. So what we find is that optimism is very much related to your sense of control. The idea is that people who have a sense that they have control over events, and control over future events tend to be more optimistic. Because if you think you have control over, you know, how healthy you're going to be, how successful you're going to be, if you're going to be in a good relationship, any of these things, if you think you have control over them, then you get to the, you conclude that you're going to steer yourself in the right direction. And therefore, you conclude that your future will be positive. So there is a very tight relationship between how much control we think we have and how optimistic we are. And again, this theory actually comes from the psychologist Martin Seligman, who, what he found, he did an experiment, quite interesting. He put dogs in a box. And they got electric shocks, and they couldn't jump out of the box. They had to. There's no way for them to escape. So what these dogs learned was that they don't have any control over the shocks, over the negative events. Then he moved the dogs into another chamber where they could actually jump over the wall and get out of the box. And so they had these shocks, these electric shocks, but they were able to avoid them by jumping over. And what he found was that dogs that were previously in a situation where they had no control simply assumed that, again, they don't have any control and didn't jump. And what he also found was that these dogs started acting as if they had depression. So they started whining and kind of lying on the floor, being inactive, and displaying symptoms of depression. And he called that learned helplessness. So the dog learned they were helpless, and therefore they didn't try to change their destiny. They didn't think they had any opportunity to do so, and they started exhibiting depression.
I can't say I'm surprised. Let's go to our next call, Elaine from Madison. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, Veronica and guest. I think I just want to bring out that the financial collapse was not a matter of simply people having too much optimism. People were misled. People were given things, poor people were given things to sign that the people who, that they didn't understand, and the bank people knew they wouldn't be able to pay, and this was done again and again. And the values of homes were inflated way up, and people were encouraged to take out loans. And, you know, this was all a manipulated thing. It wasn't a matter of people having too much optimism. Of course, if they believed that their $600,000 house had suddenly become worth $900,000, which they were told it had, and they took out big loans on that, then, of course, they were sunk if they couldn't pay it back, but it wasn't a matter of optimism.
Tali?
Yeah, so optimism is one of the components that economists identified as being related to the collapse. Of course, it's not the only one. This is a very complex situation. Many, many elements are in play. We're not saying that it's optimism alone. Of course, there's many elements. I think the idea is that the optimism was not only of the individuals, but also from higher, you know, people in the government and financial analysts that were, you know, in the market. And so the optimism of all of these people, and you know, I totally respect what she was describing here. But again, people have this inclination to want to believe the positive. So that actually means that they're more easily manipulated, because if you tell someone that, you know, they're going to make lots of money, they want to hear it. So we've actually done a study where we showed that when you give people positive information about the future, they learn faster and more efficiently than when you give them negative information about the future. What we did was we asked people, how likely are you to encounter all kinds of negative events? Suffer from cancer, be unemployed, get divorced, suffer from Alzheimer's. And they told us, for example, someone said, okay, my likelihood of suffering from cancer is about 10%. And we said, you know, the average likelihood is worse, is 30%. And then we asked them again, now that you have this additional information, tell me again, how likely are you to suffer from cancer, Alzheimer's, and so on? And what we found was that in this case, when someone started off saying, my likelihood of suffering from cancer is only 10%, and we said the average likelihood is 30, they would say, well, you know, I still think it's about 11. So they didn't change their belief much. But if someone started off saying, my likelihood of suffering from cancer is 40%, and we said, you know, the average likelihood is much better, it's about 30, so we gave them positive information about the future, the next time around they said, oh, you know, maybe it's 33. So they changed their estimate a lot. They changed their beliefs a lot when they heard positive information, much more than when they heard negative. And we've done a brain imaging study showing that this is because our regions from our frontal lobe, which is a kind of the front part of our brain, they encode positive information about the future much more efficiently and much more strongly than negative information, and therefore that information can help in changing beliefs.
Well, our guest this hour is Tali Sharat. She's a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Centre for Neuroimaging at University College London. Her latest book is called The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. And we're curious to know what you think this hour. Do you think the brain is hardwired toward optimism? And if you had a choice, would you rather be depressed and realistic, let's say mildly depressed, or more happy and unrealistic? What do you think the advantages are in both of those scenarios? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this Friday on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Join us today for Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Today, Joe Palka is guest host, and today's show has a look at Asia's space race and why U.S. military officials are keeping a close eye on it. This hour, we're talking about the brain and how it seems to have a natural inclination toward optimism. Not extreme optimism, but enough to make things look a little bit rosier in the future than they probably will be. Our guest is Tali Sharat, a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Centre for Neuroimaging at University College London, and her book is The Optimism Bias. We'll take our next call now. We've got Tony from Aquanago. Hi, Tony.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to touch base. I'm a 25-year-old guy, just I found myself in a situation of some sort of depression in my early 20s, and then decided to surround myself with a number of optimists, for the most part, just friends that adopted the philosophy of it always works out. And we put ourselves in situations here and there, and we've kind of adopted this philosophy and lived it. And I wanted to see if the guests had any comments on group optimism.
Oh, interesting. Tali?
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting question, which is one that I've been meaning to study. I actually kind of have been trying to put together an experiment to study exactly that. Because I'm quite interested to see whether when people make decisions together and when they make estimates together, are they going to be more optimistic or less optimistic? My hypothesis, and it's just a speculation, that when we come together, we become more optimistic rather than less. We kind of fuel each other's optimism, and our estimates are probably going to be a bit more optimistic, but I don't have the data yet, but it's really interesting. And I think, again, that's one of the reasons why when you look at this situation, when people's estimates come together, such as the financial market, in those situations, that's when the optimism really kind of becomes quite huge. I don't have the data yet, but it seems to me that you're probably right, that when you kind of come together, you become more optimistic, and one person's optimism just fuels the other one's.
Environment must be very strong when it comes to optimists. Do we know that if you grow up in a family of optimists, if you're more likely to have that sort of same trait yourself?
Well, we don't really know that, but we do know that there's a genetic component. And there are twin studies showing that identical twins have more of the same level of optimism than non-identical twins, suggesting, you know, so both identical twins and non-identical twins live in the same family, so they share environment, but the identical twins have a genetic similarity as well, and they have more similar optimism. I think it's about 20% more or so. So I think there is an environmental component, and it seems that on top of that, there's quite a big genetic one as well.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for that call, Tony. And we move next to Nancy in Mequon. Hey, Nancy.
Hello. I have a friend who is manic depressive, and recently she started spending a lot of money, and which is a sign that she's going into a manic phase. Mm-hmm. And she does not want her daughter to know that she's headed into this manic phase, which will probably get worse, because she likes it better than being depressed. She came right out and said that. And my sister, who works with mentally ill adults, said that most of her manic depressive clients actually prefer being manic. They don't want their meds adjusted to bring them down from the manic phase for that reason.
Right, I suppose because it feels better. It always feels better to be happy than to be depressed. Tali, what about people's role in their mental states, if they can tilt one way or the other?
Yeah, so manic depression is really interesting, and you know, the description is quite accurate that people, of course, don't like the depressive state, but they somewhat do like the manic state, even if at the end of the day it can have quite disastrous results. So, for example, overspending, as you said, you know, during the manic state you spend quite a lot, and then, you know, when you get out of the manic state you might be in debt. So there can be quite long-term negative outcomes to your manic state, but at the time it feels quite good, and that's why people go off the medication to get into kind of that manic state. It is quite interesting to me, because it's something, again, we haven't tested yet, but we're kind of interested to see whether your predictions about the future, whether your optimism bias is going to be different when you're in a depressive state or in a manic state. And to see that within one individual going from pessimism to optimism is quite interesting. It'll be very interesting also to look into the brain and see whether the mechanisms that we've identified to be related to optimism can be seen in these people when they are in manic, but then the opposite will be seen when they are in the depressed state. So it's quite an interesting case study. Of course, there's medication for the manic depression, and of course it doesn't work on all patients, but on many patients it is successful in keeping somewhat of a balance.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Nancy. And we'll take an email next. This is from Colleen, who wants to know, how does risk aversion figure into this? Is there a correlation between a person's level of risk aversion and their level of optimism?
Yeah, that's interesting as well. So risk aversion some people are risk-liking and some people are risk-averse. And that means that risk aversion means that we don't like to take risks. So some people will not like to take risks. So, you know, they're not going to go bungee jumping, or they're not going to put much money into risky stocks. There are people who actually prefer risk, and they like to gamble and like to put money in risky stocks. There is somewhat of a relationship between risk and optimism, which is that if you think that things are going to be okay, if you think that the money that you're going to put in the risky stocks are actually, you're going to get, you know, quite good profits, if you think that if you're doing something risky like driving really fast or bungee jumping, you're going to be fine because everything's going to be fine in the future, then in fact, you're not seeing these actions as risky, right? It's not that you are averse or prefer risk, rather than you have a somewhat inaccurate view of what the outcome is and what the risk is. So it's not that you are liking the risk, therefore you want to put the money in risky stocks, but rather that you don't appreciate that they're risky. You think they're going to be fine. You think that you're going to get the money. And so the two concepts are very much related.
So is that a problem then, with optimism gone a little too far?
Yes, again, that's a bit what, like we said, where extreme optimists tend to smoke because they think they're going to be fine, right? So yes, it can be that way. Or we think that, so teenagers, for example, tend to take more risks. So you'd find teenagers engaging in risky behaviors such as driving in an unsafe manner or unsafe sex, so all of these risky behaviors. And we think that maybe that is because
teenagers are more optimistic because their parts of their brain, the frontal lobes, have not yet fully developed. And again, this is something that we're testing right now.
Oh, the front part of their brain hasn't fully developed? Is that what you
said? That we know. We don't need to test that. That we know that your frontal lobes are fully developed by the time you're in your late 20s. So until the kind of mid-20s, late 20s, your frontal lobes have not fully developed. So we know that. That's not something that we need to test. People used to think that they fully develop by the age of 18 to 20. Now they think it actually takes a little bit more time than that. So somewhere in your 20s. But we do know that. The question is that then related to enhanced optimism, and is that related to, is that kind of an explanation of why they are more risk-prone?
Interesting. Another call now. Let's go to Connie. She's with us from Portage. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I thought I had something sort of interesting. My mother was always very negative and very depressed. My father was bipolar, and I had three sisters. And two of us were very positive and fought through it all, and to this day we're very positive. One of them is very depressed always, and what's so funny is she has the most. But anyway, she's always depressed and negative. So then my mother remarried when I was in high school. Four children, tiny little ones, are raised up, and they're all very positive. Very positive. And I thought, it's interesting, the correlation. I wonder if genetics definitely has something to do with it.
Oh, that is interesting. Tali?
Yes, absolutely. Genetic has a lot to do with it. I mean, a lot of the first kind of ideas of how genetic works in mental illnesses, such as bipolar, that's manic depression, and depression and other different conditions, was to actually look at families, was to actually build a family tree and to try and, you know, and see who has a condition, who doesn't have the condition, and from that to try to estimate how much the genetics actually matter in that specific illness. And both bipolar and depression is quite heavily genetic.
Well, if it seems to be an advantage to have this slight bent toward optimism for the brain, mm-hmm. why is there still that outlying 20% that doesn't seem to have it?
Well, the way that we think about it, that any trait in the population that is in a large percent of the population is probably adaptive and probably evolved to have that. So, for example, if you think back in time, if optimists were more likely to live longer because of the advantages to their health, they were more likely to have more kids, right, and procreate. And therefore, their genetic optimism, genetic gene, would carry on. And then over time, they'd be more and more optimistic and less pessimistic. But that doesn't mean that it's going to be 100%, right? So, Any trait that's good or bad, you'd have not any trait, but a lot of these traits, you'd see that a lot of the population have this trait, but some don't. And it's just how genes kind of carry on and how we evolve. So I think what's more interesting to me is the amazing fact that 80% of the population tend to have this optimism bias. Less surprising is that we still have 20% who don't.
So maybe in 1,000 years, everyone will have it. Maybe that trait will have been selected out.
Maybe, although I'm not quite. It's interesting. That's an interesting question because I don't know at this point. It's interesting to see whether, with everything, with all the modern technology and medicine and all of that, it's interesting to see if still the effect will be so pronounced. If still the optimists are the ones who are actually over time will be more likely to survive in the very far future. Because, of course, everything's kind of changed now from what it was before. And so it will be interesting to see if that still kind of continues.
I think we've got time for one more call. Let's take Peter in Madison. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to take issue a little bit with the premise that one either has to be unrealistic and happy or depressed and realistic. And I'm wondering if you're... guest is familiar with this wonderful new institution that we have here in Madison called the Center for the Investigation of Healthy Minds. That's run by Richard Davidson and was started sort of at the suggestion of the Dalai Lama, who he had been studying, hooking up to electrodes and looking at brain function for a number of years. And the Dalai Lama said, you know, you people in the West, you're always looking at what's wrong with people. And why don't you look at what's right with people and then try to replicate that? which I thought was a pretty interesting take. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Yeah, actually, that's exactly what we're doing. So what we do is we start off by looking at the healthy brain, not at the unhealthy brain. It's quite a new way to look at things, maybe in the last decade or so. We try to understand what's going on in the healthy brain, what's going on in the brain of optimists, of people who function well. After we've identified a few mechanisms, how the brain works and psychological mechanisms, then we think, okay, let's see if those are the mechanisms that break down in illnesses such as depression. And so I'm a big fan of this approach. Start with a healthy, figure that out, and then see what that tells us about the unhealthy brain, absolutely. And regarding the, you know, everyone who's optimistic are happy and everyone who's unrealistic or depressed, of course that is not the case. It's a correlation, meaning, you know, optimists tend to be happier and, you know, higher well-being than non-optimists on average, not every day, not every time of the day, but if you just sample, you know, at one point in time, you would see a correlation between the two. And of course, being unrealistic, realistic doesn't mean that you're depressed. It's just statistics. It means that, you know, out of the realistic people, more of them are likely to be depressed than not. So, of course, you know, it's not 100% relationship.
Well, Tali, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it this morning. It's fascinating stuff.
Okay, thank you very much. My pleasure.
Tali Sharat, our guest this hour. She is a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Centre for Neuroimaging at University College London. And we've been talking about her latest book. It's called The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and Chrissy Pease for answering your phone calls. Stay tuned. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. There's more coming up. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network.